Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, a conversation with Rance Hosley, the editor of Comic Book Tattoo, an anthology of stories based on the music of Tori Amos. The book's been a big success and already nominated for an Eisner for Best Anthology. We'll be discussing the project with Rance, how it all came together, and he has some tips for people that are trying to publish their own books and what it's like to kind of corral all these different creators and put together such a project. It's Rance Hosley, kids, and it was fun finally meeting you face-to-face in New York because before that, I would say you were a message board and email friend.
And yeah, I would say so.
Pre-Facebook and pre-Twitter.
Exactly. Going back to the old school of email.
Yeah, all the way back to, like, you know, 05 or 06, I guess, when we first probably met each other on the B. Clay Moore message board.
Yeah, I think so.
So there you go.
I will. I appreciate you having me on. I can't sling pop culture references with the dexterity of Brubaker or Fraction, but I will do my best to be up to their levels of profanity.
There you go. Attaboy. Very good. Well, congratulations on the Eisner nomination for Comic Book Tattoo.
Thank you very much.
Excellent.
It's an honor and a bit surreal, and I found out last night at about midnight that we're actually nominated on the long list for the British Fantasy Awards as well, under Best Comic and Graphic Novel, which is even odder because there's not, like, subdivisions of categories or anything, so it's just any comic whatsoever that came up against last year. So we're up against people like Morrison and Quietly for All-Star Superman and Joss Whedon for Buffy and stuff. And I told Steve Niles that we'd decide, since he's up with Bill Sienkiewicz for the 30 Days of Night series they did, that we would decide who would bow out gracefully by a cage match.
There you go.
And we'll sell tickets. And that's how we'll, you know, support our future endeavors, is by, you know, DVDs of the uncensored cage match.
Fair enough. I look forward to that, BitTorrenting that video when the time comes. I think that'll be great. Well, all right, let's start with the basics and everything. How did this project happen?
Well, Tori and I have known each other going on 25, 26 years at this point.
Really?
We met when I moved from the rural redneck town where I grew up in eastern Washington in 1986 and went to art school at Otis Parsons at the time it was. It's now Otis Art Institute. And at the time, the campus was located across from MacArthur Park on the edge of South Central Los Angeles. So moving from a town of 7,000 rednecks to that area was a bit of a culture shock.
Okay.
And I lived in the dormitories there, and this girl who was in the dormitories, who I became friends with, had this friend who she kept saying, you know, you need to my friend. She's, you know, this great musician. She's going to be famous someday. And one day she asked if I would help her move to her new apartment. So that's how I ended up meeting Tori, was helping her move into her new apartment.
Okay.
And while the other people who I knew from that time and era, you know, I've since lost touch with many of them, Tori and I always kind of hit it off immediately and became very, very good friends, and have been through, God knows, just a million things together. And I very much consider her like my sister from another parental set, as it were. But like in 1990, I had moved back to Washington State. I had been working on rock videos and stuff, working as a storyboard artist and a concept artist and stuff on various rock videos for, like, the Scorpions and Aerosmith and Whitesnake and stuff. And at the time that we met, she was playing piano at the bar at the Holiday Inn down by the Los Angeles airport.
Okay.
And in the interim, after I'd moved back to Washington, she'd gotten a record deal with Atlantic and was about to come out with her first solo album, Why Can't Tori Read, the first band-oriented album not being very successful and getting a critical drubbing. So as she was working on what would end up becoming Little Earthquakes, I decided that I was going to make a play for getting back into film work or animation or something like that. And a friend of mine was working as the color director for The Simpsons at the time. And he told me they were looking for storyboard artists and said, you know, why don't you come down? You can go ahead and audition, and I've got some other leads that we can set you up with. So rather than have me have to fork out money for a hotel, Tori said, yeah, you can come crash at my apartment. I'm staying with Eric, who was her boyfriend slash producer at the time.
Okay.
And you can just stay at my place and you know, until you get on your feet, you know, a couple weeks or whatever. And a couple weeks ended up being like 3 months. It was the entire summer, basically, for that period. And it was a insanely hot summer, even by Los Angeles standards. In Hollywood, it ended up being like 114 degrees.
Jesus.
And it's this little one-room apartment with absolutely no air conditioning in the heart of Hollywood. So it was, you were completely incapable of doing actually any work during the daytime. You just kind of had to like lay on the floor, you know, like a slug and not do anything. And then once it cooled off around like 7 o'clock or something, you could, you know, start working and stuff. So during that time, she was finishing up the writing and recording of Little Earthquakes. And I had these gigantic stacks of comics all over her place because I was sure that I was going to get, you know, some huge storyboard gig, which would, you know, pay me millions of dollars, and I'd be rich beyond belief. So, you know, I really didn't need to worry about money. So, of course, I rang up an incredibly high credit card bill with my first credit card and did so by going to places like Hi-De-Ho and Golden Apple and other comic shops in Los Angeles. And I think I bought, like, the entire back issue run of Cerebus, like the original prints.
Sure.
And I had various titles, like the original collections of Mage and some other stuff. And one of the books that I had laying around was Sandman. And one of the times where Tori came by and we were visiting, she started flipping through these multiple four-foot-high stacks of comics that were all over her apartment and said, well, you know, you're really into this. What do you recommend? Well, you know, let me read something. So I had given her a couple of comics, and the one that really struck out for her was the Calliope issue of Sandman, which I think is 17, but
okay.
I'm not quite sure.
I know which one you're talking
about.
It was
drawn by Kelly Jones, and it just totally knocked her out.
Isn't that cool that a Kelly Jones, you know, you would think it might be a Dave McKean, it might be some other kind of artist or whatever that would get people excited. So that's very cool that it was Kelly Jones.
Yeah, yeah, and so she came back the next day and was like going, okay, so are there any more of these? This is amazing. This is one of the most brilliant things I've ever read. You know, do you have any more of these? And so I gave her the couple of single issues that I had with me, and then went to I think Hi-De-Ho and ended up buying the two trade paperbacks that were out at the time and gave those to her. And so then about a week after that, she had a tape of new songs that she'd been working on, and she said, I want you to listen to this. And one of those songs was like the rough version of Tear in Your Hand, where she mentions, if you need me, me and Neil will be hanging out with the Dream King. So the summer goes on. I don't get any storyboarding jobs. I'm, you know, rapidly working myself into a gigantic mountain of debt and in thousands of dollars running up this credit card. And Tori's finishing up the album, and San Diego comes around. And I figure, okay, well, I've got a last-ditch effort here kind of to hopefully make some kind of splash at San Diego, get, you know, a comic gig of some kind. Because at that point, I had been doing various black and white short stories and stuff for groups like Caliber and Innovation and,
okay,
you know, different, not quite B-level companies, but where a lot of people, you know, used as staging grounds, basically, to figure out, you know, what they were doing and explore some really, you know, interesting things with the comic format and stuff. And,
sure.
And I think, you know, Caliber was excellent for that. Gary Reed was very good about, you know, really encouraging, you know, his creators to really kind of cut loose and tell those kind of stories that they wanted to, you know, for both good and ill.
And to refresh people's memories, I mean, beyond the Bendises and the David Macks and the Ed Brubakers that were there, Don Kramer, Phil Hester, yourself, I mean, you know, it's, I'm trying to think of other...
Crow, like, originally, you know, David O'Barr, Jim O'Barr's Crow originally came out
there
of
you go.
Caliber. And, I mean, it was, you know, you had Vince Locke's Dead World, which presaged the whole Walking Dead thing, mm-hmm, by, you know, a long shot. And there were really, you know, Guy Davis,
That's right.
A ton of really brilliant people
whose
first work came out of there. And then there was me. So I was kind of determined that it's like I was going to get a real comic gig, one that didn't pay maybe on sales and that, you know, actually had like some upfront cash involved.
Okay.
So I had talked to a friend of mine who was going down, and we made plans to go down, and I found out that Neil Gaiman was going to be a guest. So unbeknownst to Tori, I snuck an early mix of the album out of her apartment and took it down to the convention. And stood in line, and I never stand in line. I don't care how much of a fan I am of someone. I'm just not going to stand in line for a signing. And God bless people who are willing to do that, but I'm just too hyper, and I have too much lack of self-control in order to be able to, like, stand that long for something.
Well, don't you feel, too, when you're in a line like that, and I feel the same way, that it's like I'm at a convention, there's a million things to do. I'm not going to wait 2 hours in line to do one thing when there's 50 other things I could be doing now.
Exactly. And,
so
and it's one of those things where I feel like I'm missing opportunities every minute that I stand
I feel the
there.
Same way. Go ahead.
So I stood in line for the Taboo booth. The Spider-Baby Graphics booth, which was Steve Bissett's company that put out Taboo, and they were also, at the time, Neil was working with Mike Zulli on Sweeney Todd,
okay.
Which the first chapter had just come out in Taboo and ended up being the only chapter of it that was published, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And I went ahead and stood in line, got paid for a sketch from Zulli, which I think is probably the only sketch I've ever paid for, but I'm such a huge fan of Mike's work, and stood there waiting, and while Neil was off to the side of Michael, I handed Neil the tape and said, this is a friend of mine, she's really good, she sings about you, don't sue her. And Neil just kind of looked a little puzzled, and I said, oh yeah, and we have a party tonight. Which every year, my friend who was the color director for The Simpsons, Andrew Brando, who's gone on to be an acclaimed gallery painter, who was my roommate during college when I was at art school.
Okay.
Every year for San Diego, we would do this thing called Ouch, which was a flip book mini comic that he would write one story and I would draw it, and I would write a story and he would draw it. And there were like 8 issues of it, and so every San Diego we would have a hotel room party and invite anyone who came, give them free copies of Ouch, and basically just use it as a excuse to get completely and utterly shit-faced. And so I gave Neil a flyer for the party and said, and we're having this party tonight, you know, please feel free to show up, figuring there was not a chance in hell that, you know, that would ever happen. So that night, who shows up? Bob Schreck and Neil Gaiman and Mike Dringenberg and Tom Orzechowski and Reed Waller and Kate Worley, and all of a sudden, there's this tiny little room in the Hotel San Diego that we had, and to put the Hotel San Diego in context, the scene in Traffic, the movie Traffic, mm-hmm. where they're holed up in San Diego with the whole drug dealer that's in criminal protection.
Yeah.
Or in, you know, that's the Hotel San Diego. It is a dive by the diviest of standards. But hey, man, it was $20 a night.
Attaboy. There you go.
And it's walking distance to the convention center. And since then, the Hotel San Diego sadly has been destroyed. But so we're in this room that's maybe 20 feet by 20 feet and has about 78 people jammed into it. There's no air conditioning. It's hot as hell, and all we have is warm pre-mixed Brass Monkey and warm Miller High Life. So no one can tell you I don't know how to fucking throw a party. I'm telling you right now. and I found out like a while back that Chip Mosier, who's the marketing director for Boom, was also at that party. And at the same time, he was a fan, you know, who had no, like, professional connection to comics or anything of that. So there ended up being a lot of people who were in attendance at that party that, in hindsight, you're like, wait a second, you were at that party? I have no recollection of this thing. So Neil and I got to know each other a little better, argued about the relative merits of Aleister Crowley over warm Miller High Life, and talked a little bit about the music. And that was pretty much that. And then about 3 months later, Neil sent me a postcard saying, I appear to have misplaced your friend's phone number. I really like the tape. Can you get me in touch with her? And so then Neil ended up getting in touch with her, and they've been fast friends ever since then, you know, name-dropping each other, you know, ad infinitum between their mutual works, both on the comic side and the novel side, and on her albums. So from there, you know, Tori and I have been talking about doing a project in various incarnations. At one point, we started doing an interactive project that would be included on the Choir Girl Hotel CD. And that fell apart when, you know, at the hour when we actually moved into production, Atlantic Records, who had previously been very excited about it, said, "Wait, you want us to pay for this? you want us to give you money? No, are you fucking out of your mind? We thought you were going to do this just for free, and no, we're not going to give you back end on the albums or anything. Are you crazy? What?" So that ended that. And, you know, time went on. We kept talking about, you know, doing different projects and stuff like that. And it really was a matter of, you know, for one reason or another, something wouldn't happen. So then 2 years ago at San Diego, Derek McCulloch and I were signing preview copies of the graphic novel we're doing for Image called Displaced Persons. And the Bell and Sebastian book, Put the Book Back on the Shelf, had just come out from Image. And I had seen it, and I will fully admit here, I, you know, absolutely fucking loathe Bell and Sebastian. I think it's,
That's very funny.
He claimed Moore and I have this discussion back and forth because he's a big Bell and Sebastian fan.
I
just cannot fucking stand them. It's twee and precious and everything I really get annoyed by in indie music. And I say this as an indie music fan, but it's just like, to me, it's just like, oh, God, you're the encapsulation of everything bad. But that said,
yes.
I love the book.
Okay.
You know, and to me, that was kind of like a perfect, because I love anthologies, so I was just kind of like, well, you know, there's some people I know in it, and I'll go ahead and pick it up. And I love the book, and I thought, wow, this would be really great, because the songs that to me were more successful were the ones that didn't do like an illustrated lyric kind of thing, or being kind of like so staunchly beholden to the source, you know, material.
Mm-hmm.
that used it as a kind of jumping off point to tell, you know, its own story.
I understand.
And you know, from there, it had kind of been puttering in the back of my head that, like, well, you know, this was good, but it'd be really great with Tori's music. Because, of course, you know, I'm completely arrogant like that and think that, you know, my ideas are going to be better than anyone else's. So as I was leaving on the Sunday of San Diego, literally, I had everything packed up. I'm walking out, and I said to Joe Keating, who's the marketing director for Image, you know, so you know that Bill and Sebastian thing you did. So hypothetically speaking, if you had the possibility of doing one with, say, Tori Amos, would you be, and I didn't even get finished, he's like, done. Let's do it. Get it set up. We'll make it happen, whatever you want to do.
Wow.
So that pretty much was how that started. Then I gave Tori a call, and we started exchanging emails back and forth, just like shooting ideas back and forth on, should we do this? If we do this, what will it be? And spending a lot of time just discussing things like format, discussing the idea of making sure that she wasn't represented in the book, like, visually, that someone didn't do, like, a story about, you know, going to a Tori concert,
right,
or something like that.
Tori Amos meets Santa.
it's Tori Amos and Santa versus the Martians.
Exactly,
here we go.
Yeah. You know,
it's the sequel you never waited for.
Kiss Saves Christmas, or whatever that thing was, that family on Family Guy that they're watching, or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're just like, oh, my God, I appear to have been slipped tar heroin in this beverage of some nature.
So
there was a lot of discussion back and forth on not just in terms of what it should be, but if we should do it, because we really felt like if we're going to do it, it had to, at the same time, around the same time, there had been the announcement that, you know, Avril Lavigne was doing some quote-unquote manga thing, Courtney Love was doing some manga thing.
Oh, I remember that, okay.
Yeah, which was just a cash-in, basically, on their
right
name. And really, there was a real concern on our part that, you know, it would be seen as like, oh, okay, great, you know, you're just, you know, slapping your brand on it, and, you know, trying to, you know, make the quick cash grab thing. So that was one of the reasons why we made sure that her name was not on the cover of the book,
mm-hmm.
because we wanted there to be a distinct. We knew, first of all, that Tory fans are incredibly enthusiastic, shall we say.
Okay.
They will follow her to the ends of the earth, and if she, you know, has something out, they know about it. They have a very strong vocal network that discusses things. So we knew that her fans would know about the book, and that we would market it and make sure that, you know, doing interviews and such, that they would know about it. But we really wanted it to not, for someone who isn't a Tory fan or someone who perhaps doesn't like Tory's music, that it wasn't an obstacle. You know, that it wasn't a matter that, like, they'd walk past and go, wow, that looks interesting. Wait, it has Tori Amos on it. Oh, you know, and immediately write it off in much the way that I would, you know, write off Bill and Sebastian or something.
I understand.
I'm sorry, Clay. I've got to get my digs where I can. So, once all that was done, we ended up getting to the point of getting basically our wish list of who we wanted to participate, you know, what songs, if any, were off limits, you know, from her catalog, because we really wanted it to make, we wanted to make it like a fully representational kind of swath through her whole discography, with
sure.
the exception of the covers album.
Okay, because, okay, that obviously would be the what's off limits then are the covers that she did.
Exactly.
Okay.
And, you know, part of that's rights, and also
of
part
course.
Of it's, you know, we didn't want it to be her interpretation, an artist's interpretation of her interpretation of
yeah.
you know,
yeah, the
like,
third cousin to that song, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you kind of get into a Final Crisis situation there where, you know, the world's cracked open and nothing makes sense anymore.
Tori Prime has arrived. She is displeased with that story.
Exactly. But wait, didn't that save the earth? But yeah.
Oh, wow.
So that's really the last thing we wanted.
Okay.
So from there, we start contacting people, and I honestly expected maybe 10% of people to, you know, pony up to it and say, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. But surprisingly, it ended up being probably around like 2/3 to 3/4 of the people asked said, yeah, this sounds like a great idea.
Very
and
cool.
Then word got out and we started getting more people in. The original plan for the book was that it was going to be like maybe 120 pages. And then that rapidly grew to about 250. And then that rapidly grew to 360. And then all of a sudden we're at 480 pages. And the original design of the book ended up being altered at the 11th hour by myself and Tom Muller, who is the designer with his wife Liz, because the artists and writers didn't stick to their page limits. Okay, everyone had an assigned page limit that had to be on an odd page count.
Uh-huh.
And people got rather enthusiastic about their stories, and we had people who had committed to like 9-page stories turning in 17-page stories.
Okay.
And then all of a sudden, like, we have this very hard limit of 480 pages. All of our bids to the printers and everything are based on that 480 pages. So we're scrambling around trying to figure out, like, what things can be cut, which is one of the reasons why there isn't a table of contents, for example. So,
okay. Wow.
But it was a really great experience. I mean, all of the creators that we worked with were really, really amazing. And everyone who had worked on anthologies or, you know, worked as a comic editor or whatever, were telling me, you know, you're out of your fucking mind. You've got almost 100 people working on this project. You know, you're going to be bald and gray by the end of it. You know, you're never going to quit smoking while you're doing this.
Well, that goes without
which
saying,
is true,
yeah.
Which
yeah,
is
I'm
very
sure.
true. But, you know, you don't want to do this. It's going to end up being a disaster and all these things. And we had the submission for the initial outlines for the story, which was like a one-paragraph, basically, pitch line.
Okay.
Was due January 31st. December 31st. First scripts were due at the end of January. Layouts were due February. And final art had to be turned in April 15th. And we had a month of buffer built into the schedule.
I understand.
Because everyone else is, you know, has their own projects. And
absolutely.
Stuff. And, you know, you can't expect, it, like, an anthology to take precedence, so, you know, you have to leave some slip in there for people's schedules.
Sure.
But then the printer calls us with, like, 3 weeks to go to the 15th saying, oh, no, we need the pages now if you want to make San Diego.
Oh, Jesus.
And basically just hacked a month off the schedule. And we're like, no, we've got this in writing. You committed to this. You're going to do this. And so we went back and forth, and Image went back and forth with the printer and finally got them to say, okay, if you get us the stuff by April 27th, we'll commit to the date. So I was very clear with all the creators that, look, you know, we had the printer, you know, screw up in terms of the schedule. They basically shaved off all our buffer time.
Right.
If your pages are not turned in at midnight on the 15th, your pages are not going in. And your story won't be in, and I'm sorry about that, but I have no other options. And we only had one story miss. So it was pretty amazing to see everyone not only deliver, but also deliver on the level and the quality that they did within those kind of time constraints, and to really understand, you know, kind of what was at stake in terms of, like, the overall big picture of it. So in hindsight, perhaps putting the deadline on tax day, not really a fucking brilliant idea on my part.
I know that from a interview scheduling standpoint. Everyone's just like, yeah, I'm really busy tax week, but I'm like, no problem, don't worry about it. So, yeah, but amazingly, you got what you needed.
Yeah.
Stunning.
And I, you know, it's one of those things where I've said it so many times that, like, you have, when you start any creative project, whether you're talking music or whether you're talking, you know, a script or art or, you know, anything that's a creative endeavor, you kind of have this, you know, Platonian ideal in the back of your head where if everything comes together, that's exactly how it should be, you know. And in reality, you learn as a, you know, as a professional creator that it's never going to meet that, or that it very, very, very rarely meets that. And the fact that it doesn't is kind of the incentive that keeps you pushing forward and keeps you trying to strive for better and, you know, upping the standards the next time out. You know, so that you can keep going upward and further, and, you know, not kind of stagnate out. But I will say that the Comic Book Tattoo, like, across the board, either met or exceeded, like, the initial idea that I had and the kind of crazy vision in the back of my head of what this thing should be. And I still look at the book to this day and just kind of go, what in fuck's sake? I cannot believe this is actually done. It's out. It looks this good. What, you know?
No, it's an amazing product, and what I like about it is the diversity of the art and stories and the approaches to each song and how it was interpreted, and it's what I look for when I get an anthology. You want to see a bunch of different styles, and you want to see this, and it's my first exposure to a lot of people in this book, but I think there are a lot of recognizable names as well, and all you have to do is, if you know, you go and look at the description and stuff, you'll see them. I don't want to leave anybody out, so I'm not going to say any names. But you know, there's a good grouping here of A-list creators, and everybody involved did incredible jobs. Even the names I didn't know, it was exposure to another A-level artist and an A-level production.
Well, and there was a lot of thought that went into that too, in terms of genre. It was important for us that we knew a lot of music fans. You don't normally
hold on, Rance.
Comics.
Rance, I'm getting that.
Yep.
I'm getting that burbling right now on the line.
How's it now?
Same.
Hang on a second here. Let's see if I can fix this. I bumped the cord, so that.
Ah, okay. And that's what I was going to ask, if it was any type of loose cord. So yeah, why don't you?
Is that better now?
Yes. So
okay.
Go ahead and start your statement again.
I maintain my level of caffeination.
Nope, no problem. I have water by me.
Okay. So are we still okay?
Yeah, go ahead and roll.
Okay. Well, there was a lot of thought that went into the selection of everyone, because we knew that there would be a lot of fans that were music fans that picked up the book that weren't normally comic readers,
mm-hmm.
and that would pick it up strictly on, like, Tori's name, or that they were, you know, music fans or whatever. And I really saw part of this as, you know, being able to be an evangelist to some degree for the comics, you know, industry and for the format. And we really wanted it to be reflective of, regardless of genre, like, the overall quality of what comics can be, you know, and to really show kind of the breadth of styles and genres and approaches that are being implemented in modern comics,
mm-hmm.
that it can almost be like a time capsule of what comics can be like right now. And so it was very important that we had web comic artists in there, that we had some big-name mainstream creators in there, that we had manga creators in there, that we had both the quote-unquote arty indie school a la, you know, Fantagraphics or Top Shelf, mm-hmm. as well as the more, you know, mainstream genre-oriented independent comics, i.e. things like Dark Horse and, you know, Image and stuff like that. And so there was a lot of back and forth in terms of, you know, picking the roster so that it would have that kind of breadth, but it would also have, like you were saying, the recognizable names, the ones that would be big draws, but also that would have, you know, people who had done maybe nothing that had been published or had done like a couple of things that were that weren't known to the general public, but that there was no denying their level of talent, their level of skill, and knowing that when other people saw their stuff, they'd be like, "Wow, this person's great! I can't believe I've never heard of them before."
Exactly.
And you know, and like you were saying, that's a huge appeal to an anthology, is that a good anthology introduces you to new creators who, you know, you love their stuff, you might never have heard of them before, but you know, it whets your appetite for their stuff, and you go out and, you know, look for more work of theirs, and really that was one of the kind of critical things that we wanted to accomplish with it. So I'm glad that you feel that it did that.
Where, as far as going to the music side, who was receptive to, you know, hear about this and help you promote this thing from a media standpoint?
AOL, especially, and MSN were very enthusiastic supporters. Music media places like Paste Magazine, mm-hmm. and Spinner, which is used to be a digital CD thing that you could buy in stores, and I guess has gone online only now. And it was kind of surprising, actually, how much print media took to it, and like the enthusiasm that we got from kind of unexpected sectors. We actually had an Angelican Library ordered 3 copies and were very enthusiastic about it, and evidently had emailed other Angelican libraries about it, recommending it.
You know, much like when you first saw the anthology Flight, and I think people were blown away at the diversity and the joyous creation that came through in the stories and stuff, that's the same kind of feeling you get from this book. So I'm not normally a independent fan, but stuff like this does, you know, excite me, and it does, and impresses me in a huge way, and that's why it's a great production and a value at both price points, at hardcover and softcover.
What was so satisfying to me with it was I'm such a fan of so many of the creators that are in the book, and seeing some of those stories and some of those partnerships, because in a lot of cases, like, I matched like writers up with artists. Because
I was
like,
going to ask about that. Okay.
And say, you know, oh, well, I definitely want to participate, you know, who's available. So like the Ryan Kelly, John Nay Reber, take on Winter was yep. one of those cases. And it's one of my favorite stories. I mean, it still just guts me every time I read it. It's one of those things where their individual abilities are so strong, and yet together they do something that is just, I think, transcendent. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. And then you've got like the last story in the book, which is based off of A Pretty Good Year, which is by Derek McCullough and Colleen Duran.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, previously I think they had met a couple of times, but it was one of those things where I really, you know, strongly pushed. I'm like, I think you guys would work really well together. I think your styles would really complement each other. And now they're doing a graphic novel for Vertigo as a result of that.
Oh, that's terrific. Oh, that's really cool.
You know, that makes me feel slightly better for having delayed the graphic novel that Derek and I are working on and have been working on forever at this point, which is very late because I'm a little too busy to be drawing at this point as much as I should be. So. And I think the thing that I run Panel and Pixel, which is a forum that was formed after Warren Ellis shut down the Engine Forum. and in part is set up to help aspiring creators talk to established creators. It's a frustrating mindset change that you see in a lot of, especially like young creators, where they feel like, if I'm going to be a creator, if I'm making money at it, or if I have to worry about the business aspects of it, I'm a sellout. Really, it's one of those things where it's very hard to get through to some people that,
sure,
look, you know, being a good business person and being smart about things like business and your career and that, it has nothing to do with being a sellout. It has to do with giving you the leverage and the ability to do the things you want to do and to actually create for a living rather than having to do things like, you know, have three, you know, part-time jobs,
right,
in order to just keep the lights on.
Yep.
Because really, when you're doing that kind of stuff, the last thing in the world you feel like doing when you come home off a third shift at 11, you know, p.m. at night is sitting down at the drawing table or sitting down at the keyboard and writing. So I can tell the people who get it right away, or if they don't understand like the nuances of it, they're open to, I don't want to say the experience of it, but the kind of mindset difference that it takes. And like Brandon Seifert is a perfect example. He does a book called Witch Doctor, which he's been putting out independently, and I think he's going to end up being a massively huge success as a writer and as a creator, because he's got really unique, brilliant ideas that touch on the same kinds of themes and standards that people love in comics. But he does that wonderful thing of bringing his own unique flavor and twist to it in the same way that, you know, people like Brubaker and Fraction and Bendis, you know, do, and making it, you know, identifiably and distinctively their own. And I think people like that are the ones who, at the risk of sounding all Whitney fucking Houston here, you know, are the future kind of things.
Good luck with Comic Book Tattoo. That's great, man. Nominated for an Eisner. That's got to feel wonderful. And
it feels pretty good. I still am a little disassociative, I guess, about it. Just kind of like, what? Really? What?
Well,
everyone kept telling me at San Diego, oh, you're going to get nominated for an Eisner. I'm like, yeah. Okay, whatever.
No, it's a beautiful book, man, and we will follow up with another conversation as more details come out about the mysterious long box.
Well, I thank you very much, John. Always a pleasure to talk to you, and we will yabber at another time.
That's Rance Hosley. Make sure you pick up Comic Book Tattoo from Image Comics, a great anthology with stories and art from some of your favorite creators, featuring stories inspired by the music of Tori Amos. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. John Suntress reminding you that Word Balloon is all over the internet. Of course, we're at iTunes, at our own homepage, wordballoon.com. Don't forget our MySpace page, myspace.com/wordballoon. Also, you can follow me on Twitter. John Word Balloon is my handle over there, all one word. And you can follow me on Facebook under my own name, John Suntress. And any questions or comments about the show, make sure you come to the Word Balloon forums at wordballoon.com. Or you can reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2009.